Once upon a time, all of the Packet Pushers shows was a bunch of engineers that got together to talk. Good, bad, ugly, whiny, bitchy. Sometimes we even said nice things and praised people for doing something awesome. But generally, we've sort of wandered away from that over time because we had so much content coming in from people who were really interesting to talk to. And Ethan and I sort of followed down that path. So what we've decided to make a bigger point and force ourselves to be, to remember where we came from and have the round table. So as you can see in front of you, there's a round table and around it are a bunch of people. Joining us is Matthew Alley, Darren Johnson, Anthony Miloslavsky, and Mark Johnson. Anthony, I hope I got your name right. I apologize.
Yeah, that's close enough.
Close enough?
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is just have a chat, a chin wag, where people sit around and flap their gums and noises will come out and hopefully it'll turn into something legitimately useful to you as the valued Packet Pushers audience. So welcome to the round table, everybody. I hope you appreciate the plastic tablecloth I put on there and the beautiful Scottish plaid pattern I bought when I was in Scotland 5 years ago. What a tablecloth.
It's wonderful.
So who wants to kick us off with something to talk about?
I can start, Greg.
Sure.
So recently I've been focusing on a specific type of network automation at work. So the concept is called Ops as a Service. Mm-hmm. The gimmicky name might make you throw up a little bit in your mouth, but it's not a new concept. I personally got it from a presentation by Damon Edwards. We can link to that later.
Mm-hmm. It'd be in the show notes, yep.
So the idea of Ops as a Service is to observe how various teams request work from your silo, network silo in our case, and implement the ability for those teams to do so in a programmatic way. Mm. Now, so let me give you a quick example. You observe that the majority of requests towards the network team are either switch port turnups or firewall rules. Now, you want to focus on automating those tasks. And instead of leaving those pieces of automation locked inside of your silo, you expose them to the organization,
right?
You know, via API or some other way.
So this is kind of like anti SDN in a way. Well, not anti, but it's what I think of as the one footstep down the path to SDN. If you automate the tasks that you have today, like adding rules to a firewall or changing an access list, what you're doing is getting some of the benefits of SDN in terms of repeatability, accuracy, and probably a rollback mechanism. If once you get past writing the script to do it, you write a script to undo it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I personally think the idea is to have your team, move a little bit towards design and governance and move a little bit away from human implementation. So I guess similar to what you're doing in public cloud where there's no defined network engineer role.
Well, no, I think in large teams in public cloud, there is a network engineering role, but you don't spend your time standing up firewall instances or load balancers and then learning arcane configurations for them. They tend to start to move into things like load balancers from your AWS provider, like AWS or Google Compute, or you use a service proxy, which does right. The same load balancing function and gives you the visit. There's a whole bunch of different ways. So the networking jobs don't go away in the cloud, I don't think. So I do kind of think that the first step down the path to software-defined networking in my mind is you write a script and you automate a piece of work, so configuring a small thing. And then then you go and write another script for another thing. And then all of a sudden you find you've got enough scripts that you actually need something to orchestrate all the scripts. And then you realize that actually if you had a framework to orchestrate those scripts instead of doing them the old way, then you start to turn to SaltStack and Ansible. And then you realize that simplifies a whole bunch of stuff. And then you can do more and more and more. And then eventually you start to end up with saying to yourself, why am I spending all this time writing scripts? And you end up at the point of buying something like an ACI or an NSX, where somebody's actually done all that for you.
Hang on a second, Greg, though. You're going on and on. Anthony, I want to go back to you because I thought I heard you say ops as a service, and then we started talking about automating infrastructure. So when you say ops as a service, what are you actually talking about? Just getting action from your ops people, or are you talking about the infrastructure side of things too?
Yeah, so I think the important distinction is when you talk about network automation, one side of the spectrum, you have your Python scripts, Ansible playbooks that your engineers are running to do whatever everyday tasks. This specifically exposes those tasks to other sides of the silos. So your systems team, your application teams, that way they can call those tasks via an API, for example, And you don't really need to be involved except from a, either a governance standpoint or an approval standpoint.
Oh.
And you go from there.
So you're kind of strictly defining certain tasks that they could do and just allowing them to call that. Although, right, approval and governance would be key because they could just be like, I can call these APIs forever and things happen. Only there's finite resources. So you couldn't be, it can't be a carte blanche.
Right. And why I made the parallel to public cloud is, you know, something like security groups, you don't want the network or security engineer sitting there doing that by hand for every single application you bring up. So for the most part, you'll give freedom to the application teams to define it on their own, but you're still going to be sitting there from an approval or governance standpoint, making sure they're doing things the right way.
So, okay, you said this is a specific idea that you were working on. So the next question that pops in my head is how well do the people understand what they're asking for? So, I mean, do they have a clear enough sense of what they should be asking for to be able to make the correct programmatic call? Is there an educational process that goes into this?
There's definitely an educational process. You know, you expose an API to some teams. For some developers, that might make total sense. For other teams, that might make zero sense. So there's definitely an education standpoint. But I think it just starts with taking a process, automating it, exposing it, and then just starting to educate other teams and how you want various tasks to come in.
But then you got to write your own API too and document it for folks to be able to make those calls, yeah?
You either do that or you use some type of orchestration product. Mm. Either way, it's about the same amount of work so far in my experience. Mm.
So how do you support the API going forward? So once you've got, you know, other parts of the business using those APIs, you've actually got to sustain those well forever once that's created.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're still in early days, so that's definitely a good question. Mm. We're going to see how this develops in the next year or two.
Rack up that technical debt, baby. It's free.
Do you have a specific workflow that you're trying to push as a template or a base example?
Yeah. So in my observation, for example, a ton of work comes into our team related to firewall requests. Sure, sometimes you need to babysit those requests and get them in a format that you want. But the workflow of getting firewall rules implemented and pushed out and the approval process has just, it's done wonders for our team in terms of, from a productivity standpoint, in terms of configuration consistency. So that's been our guinea pig for now.
I have a question in relation to that. If you're standing up these scripts, facing them towards the other departments or silos, if you will, allowing them to initiate them on their own, are you building documentation of the changes into the process itself? So, you know, if somebody, a specific person, initiates one of those scripts, does it document who did what and when? So you guys can easily refer back to those?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a full audit trail. And these processes interact with our ticketing system, your IPAM, you know, various parts of the business where this information needs to be populated.
And Anthony, you're actually implementing the firewall changes via your scripts?
We are, yes.
Okay. I don't know if you can say or not, but you're probably not using ASAs, right?
No, we are not.
Okay. All right.
But yeah, full disclosure, we're probably using every other vendor except that. So.
Yeah, I ran into previous life, that being the first thing everyone wants to start with automation is, yeah, we got these firewall rules that come in. And ASAs were everywhere, and it was a non-starter. So that's why I was asking. Your success story tells me you probably weren't using those,
right? And so personally, you know, I work for a large financial organization. So the number of firewalls easily outnumbers the number of employees here. As you know, these large organizations like to guard everything. Mm. You have your HA pairs. So getting some kind of traction or some kind of consistent process, you know, towards implementing these rules, it was just huge in my eyes.
What were the challenges when you were implementing that? Has all the organization done the different things? You know, did you find bringing automation and writing code, was that difficult to bring into the organization, or was there a widespread sense of that was happening? Because a lot of people say, say to me, like, yeah, it'd be great to do that, but nobody wants to learn programming, or because the organization doesn't want to write its own programs or things like that. Is there something specific about your organization that let that happen?
You know, so personally, I took on this task. I said, why don't we try this? Why don't we see how well, you know, what kind of progress we can make? Because, you know, obviously, the more firewalls you have, the more logic you have to put into your automation, and this thing quickly grows and grows. But from a management sign-off, I found that boil the ocean is usually where network automation sputters in these large enterprises. So taking something like this, which is probably right in between, you know, you have your couple of Python scripts on the left-hand side, and then you have your full-blown CI/CD pipeline on the right-hand side, which, you know, good luck having convincing anyone to sign off on that. So taking something like this somewhere in the middle is, I would say, probably the best approach in my experience.
I work in the, you know, the network automation space fully, and just asking from your perspective, from everyone's perspective here, kind of where you see network automation at now. You know, are you optimistic about it? Is it a hype cycle? You know, where you see it now? Where do you see it going? In your own experience.
Well, so
that'd be a loaded question.
Well, so first of all, that's interesting, because what do you guys think network automation is? This is actually something that popped up on Twitter because of some tweet that I sent that was meant to be humorous. Only a few people took it very seriously and said very serious tweets in response to my humorous little tweet there. but it was a valid point brought up, which is, if network automation to you means I'm going to write a script that just does for me in a script way the same thing I would have done, you know, typing into the keyboard, then you're doing it wrong, because thinking about network automation properly implies holistic network thinking, where you're thinking about the network as a whole and making all the little boxes work together to do something rather than logging into one box and doing a configuration, et cetera. You're automating the network as a system, not network as individual devices. So, you know, that's a long way to kind of, you know, say where network automation goes is, in my mind, is networking as a system, not networking as individual devices. But you got to start somewhere. So where have you guys started? We got one example from Anthony. What else are you guys doing?
Well, not starting.
Late last year, needed to change the guest wireless password, and all of our APs. It was all statically configured on each AP, and I decided to check out Ansible, and I successfully changed all of our guest wireless passwords with Ansible, and I was pretty excited with myself, and that's the extent of my network automation so far. But for me, I honestly think that where I'm working, I suspect that we will be utilizing probably some sort of GUI powered networking devices before we start developing our own network automation system.
Well, do you see having to develop your own network automation system? Like, that would be the ultimate evolution? Or do you see a vendor supplying you a tool that manages the network, you know, as a whole, and you just kind of interact with their, what will be inevitably a single pane of glass?
Right. Yeah. I suspect that for the current location that I'm in, something like a Meraki, where there's that single pane of glass and everything just talks to each other and everything talks to the cloud. We're already looking into that based on our networking needs.
And that's a form of automation, because what you're effectively doing is paying someone else to do the automation for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you're also paying the organization to keep maintaining the automation and to keep it going. So SDN platforms, you know, like Meraki or NSX or Apstra or any of those, there's still automation or orchestration. It's just a question of who's doing the software development for you, in a way.
Yeah. And in my experience, kind of like Ethan, in that the most successful automation tasks or wins that we've gotten have been quick wins, you know, something that's repeatable, you always do, something that's clearly defined as a network service. And then you automate that, meaning that whatever steps it takes to deploy it, to provision it, to deprovision it, to record it, you take care of that. And then from there, you start looking at integration. You know, where can I how can I expose this, like Anthony said, and then how can I, you know, tie in some other systems, maybe reporting, maybe there's another group that consumes this. But you get to a point where you have to look at orchestrating it, and it for me, it always goes to like a boil the ocean conversation where, you know, if we're going to orchestrate one thing, let's orchestrate everything and all the things. And
the dependencies that are out there make that so complex. Even a small network, when you begin to think through all of the things that need to get touched to affect a particular change, and then you try to think about, well, how would I programmatically do that? You know, in your job as a network engineer, that becomes to me a very quickly an insurmountable task that's very different from the quick win. I'm going to write a bit of code or a script that does this one thing and just happens to replicate that task for me so I can get it done much more quickly and with far fewer errors. That's one set of problems. The whole, I got to touch 12 devices to accomplish this one task and I'm going to write a script to automate that for me. Ugh, that's a way more difficult, challenging thing to do that I don't know how many network engineers are going to be able to figure that out, which is why I wonder if the vendors are going to be the ones that write those systems for many of us, and you just buy the whole thing as a turnkey package and call it done.
It's funny you mentioned vendors because, as Greg likes to say, money doesn't matter to enterprises. They'll much easier for them to buy some product for X number amount of money than try to convince them to build something or use an open source product to build something. And that's really been the case in my experience where I've proposed, let's automate X or Y. And the first question was always, well, can't we just buy this and use a vendor's approach? And that's really been a struggle just because, you know, large enterprises, the longer they're around, the more snowflakes that pop up, the more processes, the more ticketing systems and all of that you have to interact with. And, you know, good luck trying to incorporate all of that into a vendor product.
And that's where you get into, can I change this one thing or can I change the whole business process? And if you're talking about changing the way the help desk talks to the networking team, that's a very difficult thing to change, I think.
In the build versus buy conversation, I'm always a build first guy, to my detriment though. But one of the things I'm not good at like golden phrases, but one of the phrases that like sticks in my head is you either have to adapt your processes, right? Mm-hmm. Or you're going to have to adapt your business if you buy a vendor solution, because they have to be all things to all people, right? Like Cisco ACI has to cover so many different types, and in order to do that, you're going to have to conform to, you got to get VMware, you have to get certain things in there, where if you build it yourself and you start trying to integrate it yourself, it's going to be a Herculean task, but you might have better successes. In my experience, I've seen that to be the case. You're gonna have sleepless nights. Yes.
You're building a semi-trailer with three trailers on the back because you don't know how much of a load, and you turn up and you've got to pick up a 1 kilo box of butter. You know, but all the features have to be there. You know, you have to have all the capacity and the capability because you don't know if you're going to pick up 120 tons worth of cargo or whether you're going to transport one kilo box. And that's the disadvantage of the vendors, is to be able to sell it to a wide enough range of customers. They have to spread their feature development out to encompass all these use cases, whereas you've only got to develop the features that are relevant to your company and your specific system and the things that you want to automate.
I've also seen the negative effect of building things your own, you know, where we've had certain platforms or systems where they were, you know, handmade, custom made to meet certain needs at the time. And they grow old, they grow stale, they become huge, and things change, needs change. And then it becomes a nightmare to upgrade or migrate. And I've seen it where we dumped a handmade product for the sake of an out-of-the-box experience, something that doesn't need to be modified and custom-made, just for the sake of ease of management and knowing that it can be updated in the future. So I think I've seen both sides of it.
Yeah, there's definitely a sweet spot there. You know, it could be that you're integrating and gluing together, you know, two vendor-provided solutions, but still sleepless nights, still Python books you got to digest, or whatever your code du jour is.
but your companies are going to, they'd be happier investing in vendor products than headcount. Is that fair to say from all of your experiences?
Yes.
I think so.
One check.
Yeah,
and one check. Net to choke too, right?
No, this is something that's been on my mind a lot lately, in that I see there's a lot of win for open networking solutions. White box, pick your NAS that has the features that you need, go with that. It should be a much lower CapEx and probably OpEx spend. Could mean you need to hire another body to get the operational flow just exactly the way you want it, because it doesn't have every tool and bolt-on thing you can imagine. But that's okay, because you end up with a solution that is custom tailored to the Snowflake requirements of your business. And isn't that a good thing? And yet the challenge there is bodies. You need people, and you need some technical skill on staff to make that go. And some other, and it seems like a lot of companies would just rather write those big checks off to the vendor for whatever the system is and keep the headcount as lean as possible. And I think that's a, it's getting to be more and more of a bad and almost illogical trade-off. I just don't know how to overcome that thinking on the part of businesses.
I think a lot of organizations struggled to do software development. 20 years ago, doing software development was incredibly difficult. Even simple things like scripting, like what we have today, is so far advanced from where we were, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that it's actually possible to write, even for a very small team, to have testing rigs. You know, you can have labs, virtual labs, where you actually run your script on a lab environment, and you have automated tests to see if, your new script will actually work. And I don't think most enterprises realize how advanced software development has become. Has anybody got a view on that?
I think that's the next, you mentioned like automated tests, and I think that's the next great evolution or advancement in automation and scripting, is that there's going to be a way where we're going to be able to have confidence to deploy, throughout the day. You're going to have confidence to say, I've run this battery of unit and integration tests, and I'm confident that this network service or this change is not going to take anything down, and we can go ahead and run with it. But I don't see the investment. That's a skill set, and I just don't see the investment oftentimes from the enterprise or enterprises in realizing that that's an entire skill set, that's bodies that you need, and that's a change in thinking that you need.
Do your companies treat you as a business partner that's valued in making the business go, or as an expense that's like, oh crap, what do you guys need budget for now?
Luckily, my company, they invest pretty well into their IT department. They send us on trainings and pay for, subscription platforms for, video training. And we're willing to invest in ourselves to make our IT department better, because I think for us, we're investing more in technology than we ever have. I don't see my company as seeing us as a pain.
Doesn't feel like an adversarial relationship in your case.
No, I definitely, if anything, I feel just honored to be there.
Can I swing the conversation? You mentioned a word there that I just wanted to take the conversation in a different direction. Let's leave automation behind, perhaps. You said online training and online textbooks. Is that working for you? I've had so many people say, I can only learn in the classroom. And I sort of look at them and think, are you like some high school kid that's not very bright and you have to actually go and have an apprenticeship to learn stuff? Do you find, or do you have an opinion, in fact, everybody, does anybody have an opinion like having a subscription to O'Reilly or any of the online training sites, where you can watch the videos and learn what you need? Are they working? Do they work for you?
They work for me. I've done both. I've done both a classroom style training where, I had to go to a different state and stay in a hotel for a week. And I've also, I currently have a subscription to the IT Pro TV and watch a ton of videos on there, because they were one of the only providers that had content on a certain subject. And that allowed me to gain proficiency where other knowledge vendors, if you will, didn't even have that opportunity. So it works for me.
What about anybody else? What do you use to keep yourself up to date to learn from?
I could never do the boot camp style, like 5-day, 3-day classes. They never seem to stick. It's always the cramming for the test. I do enjoy the more free form, learn your own pace, where I can sit down, pull some information out there, build a lab out of it, mm-hmm. and let it burn in slowly over several weeks.
Yeah, personally, I've found that it's great when your company gives you access to, you know, like an INE.com, and you have access to thousands of videos that are constantly updated with the mm-hmm. latest technologies. But honestly, I think it's really up to the individual engineers. And what I mean by that is if you're a manager and you buy your team, you know, a yearly pass for INE.com, and a year later, you're wondering why everyone doesn't know all of the technologies. It's not really a surprise. You kind of have to do this on your own time, and then you have to play hands-on on your own time to figure things out. At least that's what I think.
I agree.
I mean, it's one thing to buy a subscription for your team. It's another thing to put a structure in place so that the subscription you've bought, people have time to consume, you know, on work hours, and there's an opportunity to get that learning done. I think that's... It's if you've got budget, it's fairly easy to buy those subscriptions, but it doesn't mean that people that are working for you are going to learn anything unless you actually create that structure in which they have the opportunity to learn. Not like, yeah, and so after you're done working for me for 8, 10, you know, 15 hours today, why don't you go home and, you know, do some INE for 2-3 hours.
Yeah. But we're not going to pay you extra for that. And just because you get better as a worker, you know, sometime in the future we might give you a pay rise or a bonus, maybe after you've been useful.
I've always liked the boot camps as like a Kickstarter. You know, you fully immerse yourself in something new you're trying to learn. You're either going to a site or someone's coming there, and you know you can go from zero to fairly, you know, to novice during that boot camp and get some foundation. But then you do have to. It is incumbent on the individual to take it further and do their own learning and. YouTube is a great resource. All of those sites where you can, INE.com, any of the other ones, great resource to supplement that. But I do like, I might be weird, but I do like the boot camps to like kickstart it personally.
So Mark, you raised the topic about dealing with positive and negative vendor relationships. Have you had some experience of negative vendor relationships? Obviously, because, and then we'll contrast it with positive.
Yeah, actually I was talking to Ethan about this the other while. Quick question. Don't you mention vendors or no?
Let's just leave vendor names out of it and just say vendor A, yep. Vendor B or something. You know.
Got it. So we had a fairly large data center quote going out to the direct vendor for bill of materials, just to verify everything we were saying. The one I put out was what we ended up buying, but they came back with an oddly similar quote, but different type of hardware, let's just say. But once we started peeling into it, we realized that it didn't quite meet our needs, and they were fiddling with some of the build materials to make some things look better than others.
Mm.
That one really hurt when I called them on it. And
So one of the things that happens there is that the salespeople at vendors or resellers are often, it's called spivved. That is, they're motivated to sell a particular product or a specific thing. So, for example, right now, Cisco's got a big push around its software-defined access. So if you're actually engaging directly with Cisco or any of Cisco's resellers, they're going to really push you hard into the software-defined access because Cisco's committed to growing that market quickly. This is where knowing something about the financial markets is useful because Cisco's promised to the shareholders that this software-defined and they're going to make this much, and they said Cisco, their software-defined access is going to be this much. And the way that Cisco makes that happen is they go out and give the sales force triple bonuses for selling SD access. So the salesperson can retire three times as much of their – they have targets like, you know, $1 million a quarter or $5 million a quarter, whatever it is. But if they can sell an SD access for $1 million, that's worth $3 million of their budget. And so they get their bonuses. And so these sorts of distortions is one way it comes in. Another way that it comes in is sometimes the deals will be written by a reseller who chooses to sell a product that they know or that they're comfortable with, or maybe the Cisco person who's putting the quote together for the reseller, because resellers rarely put the quotes together themselves. They often engage somebody from the vendor in the back end. And that person might have a product that they know better than the others, so they just go with what they know. So sometimes it's a human issue. Sometimes it's a sales issue. And sometimes somebody wants to sell you what's in stock. So if you're trying to buy a particular type of switch or a particular solution you think is going to work for you, sometimes they want to sell you what they've got in stock because they want to get it out of stock so that they can not have to keep it around or return it for money. So there's a whole bunch of reasons as to why, but the most common one is the sales one. It's just straight out the commission that comes from the salespeople can be retired, and there's some sort of hidden incentive for them to sell you a product that you may or may not want. Most likely don't. Anybody else?
I'm sorry, real quick. Now, as a customer, though, what can you do?
Stand your ground, really. Be confident in, you know, have the skills and capability. A lot of customers just fold under pressure, and the salespeople are trained to apply pressure in a very subtle way. They don't call it applying pressure or forcing customers to a decision. It's called, you know, customer supporting the customer or helping the customer make the right decision. That's what they say, which is flat out lying or manipulation of people. But that's what sales is, right? It's getting people to buy the thing that you want them, whether they want it or not. And the only way you can do it is to be aware of what's happening around you. So be aware. So part of the reason that Packet Pushes at the network break was to talk about the finances was to sort of make you aware that sometimes there's a financial reason for a technology to exist or a financial reason as to why a company is pushing a product, even though it's not very good or not the right thing or not successful. So partly it's about having enough professional skill to understand that there's business reasons, there's technology reasons, and then there's also just process reasons as to why they may choose it. How do you cope with it? In my case, it's just, you know, you make sure you have enough skill, you have a good relationship with your management, to be able to communicate with them, to say to them, there's something not right here and I'm not sure what, but I think we should be either looking into the finances or asking the salesman if he's getting a back end, you know, is he getting a backhander? It's effectively bribery, right? A salesperson who gets a triple accelerator on a deal is actually being bribed to do something that's not the right thing to do, but they don't think of it like that.
I've seen in a scenario where we were trying to just roll out a relatively small project, and we were trying to be sold a certain pair of switches that I knew for certain that was overkill. Mm-hmm. And the salesperson or the project manager brought on a sales engineer, and we had this 30-minute phone call back and forth as to why we needed these fancy switches that I knew was unnecessary. And he just kept saying, you know, these what if scenarios. Well, what if, you know, your bandwidth changes, or what if your needs change, and, you know, you're future proofing and all these things. And I'm just like, no, I don't think you understand. Like, we haven't come anywhere near the caps of what we're trying to replace. So we do not need these. We need these. And I was suggesting a particular model, and the sales engineer didn't even know the specs of the model. And they were just pushing this one product. And ultimately, we ended up going with what I suggested, which was nice because my manager backed me up on that. Mm-hmm. And so knowing your product or knowing your implementation or knowing your business needs, I think, is good ammo against sales engineers trying to pitch something that you don't need.
Mm. I also like to personally keep an eye on what happens after that check clears. So what does the support structure look like? You know, everybody has bugs. Let's admit it. Every single vendor has them. There's no way around them. So what happens when you do hit these bugs? What happens when you call them? What kind of engineers are you talking to? Are you getting escalated three times before you get anyone knowledgeable? How quickly do they resolve your problems? And honestly, just based on those facts alone, I've seen some vendors fold and other vendors do really well.
Yeah, you've got to be willing to stand your ground. And as I said, you've got to be able to have some trust with your employer, you know, with your managers to say that you're able to make the right decisions and the right recommendations. That's the other side of this. It's happened to me many, many times. Usually it comes down to, I've discovered a bunch of SPIVs where the salesperson is incented to do something at a different, you know, a double or triple retiring of commissions and things like that. So
the only thing I can really do now is my mind is just start bringing in more vendors just out of spite. if anything, if nothing else.
Yeah, that is one of the things you can do, because then you can threaten them with, taking the deal elsewhere. It gives them something to think about, makes them reevaluate what they're doing.
Yes, and that just leads me to never, ever getting to a homogeneous network where I'm always in constant refresh, always in constant vendor selection. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that always gives you the upper hand, at least I think so. Yeah. It's one thing to threaten a vendor. It's another thing to tell them, hey, we already have these other vendors. We can kick you out if we want.
Yeah. It is very difficult. Like, it's not an easy thing to do, in the sense that, you know, those sorts of games that you have to play are not a very pleasant sort of thing. But they are certainly games that have to be played. It's not like it's allowed sort of thing. So.
How many of you guys are fighting the, we have this approved list of equipment or vendor internally, which it's a thing I experienced in a number of larger shops that I've supported, where, yeah, we buy this switch. Here's the three things that we approve that you can buy. And if you want to go outside of that, it's so painful that you just don't want to bother, even if the thing that's on the approved list is not exactly the right tool.
Mm.
We don't have a list. We have a... We just have, here's what we've always done.
That's effectively approved list.
Yeah, I mean, because if it's what we've always done, what's that mean? That means that a manager looks at that and goes, oh, we bought this before. This is probably safe. I'm not likely to get in trouble if it goes sideways because we have the precedent of having done it before.
Yeah, essentially it's just, here's what we've done and it's worked in the past. And when it comes time for upgrade, you look at the newest model of the same thing.
And honestly, for you as an engineer, if you're suggesting vendor B instead of vendor A in that case, it's kind of, you're behind on the line. If you choose vendor B and something goes south, they can always play the I told you so game.
Yeah, it's funny how we expect the vendors to go south. Like, we should never have a conversation that we're actually expecting to buy a faulty product. It's really sad, isn't it? But that's actually what we're saying. If I don't buy the same thing as I've bought before, I actually expect it to be faulty. And that's perfectly reasonable logic, which is kind of...
Mm. Well, it's also expected what we bought before to be perfectly faulty as well.
Exactly, yeah. So I'll take the thing that I know that there's problems with this product, so therefore I'll take the ones I know rather than the ones I don't, because I don't want to go on a voyage of discovery.
Darren, you had a topic that I find interesting here, the notion of being an expert beginner. The whole idea of you're constantly learning, technology's changing, you may be newer to the field, and getting comfortable saying, I don't know, when you're sitting in a room full of experts, maybe, or at least a field full of experts. What brought that to your mind?
Well, I started a lot with smaller shops, you know, where you're the guy and you know every moving part, every single widget, and you touched it in some shape or form. Nothing happens without going past your desk. And then I made a jump to, you know, a Fortune 500 enormous company that.
Where now you're one cog in the wheel instead of being the wheel.
Yeah, and the sheer, you know, just a funny anecdote. During my interview, my boss asked, "Do you know Verfs?" I said, "Yeah, of course I know what Verfs are." Say, yeah, there's no way you know Verfs like we do Verfs. And he was right. You know, they did things completely different. And I was going from systems engineering to network engineering, back to network engineering. So I was overwhelmed. But being comfortable, being able to say, I don't know your specific use case, or I don't know what you're talking about, especially the acronyms and jargon, it actually helped me, because people were more willing to say, oh, you wouldn't know that. That's, you know, that's a term from 12 years ago. What we really mean is MPLS. And so I've benefited in my career from just being able to do that, or just in my experience from being able to do that, to say, I don't know what you're talking about. I may have some technical reference for it, but explain that a little better. And but it's hard to do. You know, I still fight with being able to do that.
Your pride, you mean?
Yeah, for sure. You don't want to be, if you're looked at as an expert on something, or you're looked at as supposed to, you don't know what you should know. There's like these gray areas where you don't know if you should know something sometimes.
Yeah.
And I can personally agree there, just because, you know, if you get asked a certain question, you don't know it from an ego standpoint. Sure, I'll say I don't know, but next time they ask me, I'm definitely going to know. So
yeah, you go home and watch 2 hours of YouTube videos just to learn about it.
Yeah. clean up your pride. Yeah.
Yep. What I've found too is that for some reason, this, you know, this community, we've all signed up to be generalists, and there's always going to be something that comes up. We're specialists, but we're generalists, right? There's always something that comes up we don't know. And because of that, people are very willing to share what they know with you if you approach it humbly and you come at them the right way. I haven't had anyone, and I can probably go back and find somebody, but I haven't had many people belittle me or anything, you know, for asking a question. But it's always getting over that hurdle of being okay with asking questions and saying you don't know.
I think most people are like that these days, but yeah, there's certainly a few people I can look back on. They thought they were just so amazing. They didn't have time for you. You don't know? Fine, I'll do it. Get out of my way. There are those people too. It's funny, the topic of mentoring came up on Twitter a few weeks ago, and I had some people that were like, I don't have time to mentor. I'm not getting paid for that. I was like, really? Wow. I couldn't believe that response, but that was where some people came from. I find most people these days are like, yeah, I'll tell you what I know. And it's because we all know that there's so much out there we don't know, because you can't possibly keep up with it. It's just Greg and Drew and I, Chris Wall, Scott, well, all of us are trying to keep up with all the things. We can't possibly keep up with everything that's going on out there. All the companies, all the different technologies, all the different use cases and bits of tech that are solving some problem for another that you've never heard of, and companies that are inventing new acronyms and, you know, and so on. I read some of these press releases that come through. It's like, I don't even know what you're talking. Oh, these are all your things, your acronyms that you guys have made up. These aren't even industry standard things, and you're supposed to keep up with it all? No, I don't think
so. Hello, Arista. Every time he comes out with the technology, they create a name for it and then patent and trademark it. It's like, what?
Are you saying we shouldn't know what intent-driven blockchain is already?
Whatever it is, I want one.
Right.
Oh man, that sounds like it could actually be a thing. I hope you were kidding, but now I'm realizing maybe he's not.
Not yet. Trademark.
Within the last year, we actually moved our data center, which actually was an old mop closet, to a colo location. And we got a VAR involved, and we did a complete redesign of our WAN between us and that new colo. And we had this grand plan of getting fiber links from all of our branches back to this colo, no matter where they were, essentially. And some of these branches had less than 5 people in them. And so, luckily,
dedicated fiber,
I was able,
cheaper than it used to be, but still not cheap.
Right. Yeah. No, luckily, I was able to talk my boss out of the idea of getting those private fiber links back from all the branches to the colo. And I started pitching the idea of, well, what about an SD-WAN product? Because some of the problem we were trying to solve with the fiber WAN was the unreliability of broadband. And I suggested, well, why don't we look into SD-WAN, you know, with these edge devices, and look at that broadband ISP and then back it up with a 4G, you know, USB card, because there are solutions that can automatically do that. And once that was an option on the table, it was like, okay, well, what does that look like? And so in the near future, rather than doing the fiber, you know, for it to each branch, and then also rather than doing the old school site-to-site VPNs, we're looking heavily into what does an SD-WAN environment look like for us, since each branch varies in size and varies in location. You know, what would be the easiest way for scalability, especially for a growing company? And so that luckily is on my plate within the next couple of years to look at what our WAN's going to look like.
So what's your strategy for that? I mean, it sounds like SD-WAN, yeah, that would be a fit. Put a drop in two broadband providers at each site. Should be lots of bandwidth in a fairly affordable circuit, and hopefully they both don't have quality issues at the same time. And then what other requirements do you have beyond that? Where just ease of operations, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, just ease of operations and reliability and scalability. We have pretty big growth plans, and so, you know, what's the quickest way we can turn around a branch? You know, like, okay, well, all of a sudden, you know, there's an acquisition on the horizon. What does that look like? Well, rather than having to manually configure four or five devices for that branch, you know, you can have a dropship, you know, box show up on site and configure it after it gets plugged in. And those kinds of things seem pretty beneficial.
Most solutions use zero touch provisioning. So they ship from the factory. When you plug them into any internet connection, and they'll DHCP an IP address just like your computer at home. And then they'll report to the vendor's cloud platform. And when they ship from the factory, that serial number or that box is then registered to you. So they flip it to your product set. So in the case of some SD-WAN vendors, it just gets registered in the cloud. So somebody like Viptela, for example, Cisco Viptela. If you're somebody like Silver Peak, their cloud system will log the fact that it's now connected to the network and it's there, and then it will let the on-site orchestrator know that that system's ready to go. And you, the SD-WAN platform itself, like the SDN controller part of that, will then download a configuration to it. It'll do a key exchange, a public PKI key exchange, update the certificates in the box, and then you'll have already created the configuration offline. So you say, I want this. It's going to have this IP address and, you know, whatever it is that your policies you're going to have for apps and that sort of thing. And you might just say, here's the device. Just take the same policies as I've given to every other branch in this group. And then boom, it's done.
Right. Yeah. And that's definitely what we're looking for. The ease of management and deployment is a big sell. And also the idea of the possibility of some new quality of service controls, and also like the layer 7 application visibility, filtering at the branch, those kinds of options are appealing to us, because honestly, the more we move our platforms to the cloud, you know, software as a service type platforms, the less we're going to need that connectivity back to the colo. Mm-hmm. And so if we can control at the branch their quality of service and their connectivity out to the internet a lot easier than we do now, you know, that's also a big sell for us. And that's what I'm looking at.
So Silver Peak and others do this as well. I think VeloCloud does as well. I think all of them do to some different level. See, they talk a lot about internet breakout, which is where the traffic that happens at the branch goes directly onto the internet. So the question is, which traffic goes onto the internet directly? And the trick there is to manage whether it's Office 365 or Salesforce. How do you recognize that traffic? You can't, you know, do ACLs because you don't know what IP address Office 365 is on this week and if there's content delivery networks in front of it. So you need some tool that does that. And so most of the SD-WAN providers actually have cloud platforms which are using machine learning to learn where Office 365 is this week and then automatically update the rules every hour or every day. All right, does that make sense? So you can create a rule that says Office 365 breakout locally, and then the rest of it's taken care of for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the benefits we're looking for. Mm-hmm.
The second one is, this is one that Silver Peak was talking about. We've done a couple of coffee breaks with them. Disclosure, they're a sponsor of the show. But they're talking about how they can say, I can do local branch breakout, but I'll forward it into a cloud service like Zscaler. And that cloud service will then log it all and check that there's no malware coming in and out, and do authentication so you can authenticate the user, sometimes against the SD-WAN appliance, sometimes against the cloud service, in the same way that you do today with a proxy server in the data center. And then it just all gets handled up there. And then Zscaler does some security scanning on it and then checks that whatever it is in it, and it passes. So the SD-WAN can actually then dynamically integrate with cloud-based security services that do the security functions that you used to do back in the data center. So maybe that's a feature you're looking for in the SD-WAN.
My biggest gripe with the SD-WAN market, at least from a vendor selection standpoint, is there's so many vendors out there. And it seems like just when one seems to rise to the top from a reputation standpoint, you know, somebody buys them. And then you're kind of in a holding pattern because you have no idea of what that product's going to look like under the new umbrella.
That's true of any market. I mean, the SD-WAN is still new, relatively new. It's only 3 or 4 years in the marketplace. Most networking technologies take 5 to 10 years to stabilize. And you might not have worked with startup technologies over the years. So networking has been really, really stagnant since the mid-1990s when, you know, we stabilized into like a couple of dominant players, and then eventually Cisco grew to dominate most of the marketplace. So there wasn't a whole lot of decisions to make. But having this diversity of choice is actually an opportunity for you to learn a whole lot of stuff and to really give value to your employer and to differentiate between all of the different solutions on the table. So don't see it as a problem. See it as an opportunity to do something fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm. And they are all different, by the way. So they're not all, you know, the difference between a BMW and a Mercedes is pretty slim, right? And picking one or the other is really like, I just happen to like one car or one brand, or I saw an ad 20 years ago and it influenced me to think that BMW is, you know, whatever. There are genuine differences. One's electric and one's diesel. The vendors are very far apart. There's not much convergence at this time, in my opinion anyway.
Yeah, still honestly, lots of differences. Yeah.
Outside of the technology side of it, how does the problem I've always seen is we have 300 some odd offsites and we'll knock down 10, bring up 12 every year. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with things like ISP management? Because if the whole point is to save money in the long run, if you forget to cancel the circuit because somebody at the site borrowed up on a company credit card and it gets paid every month, eventually it's just going to become a
So I guess like I've seen this a couple of ways. Like many, many years ago, like before the way the market settled out as it did today, some companies actually had a person whose full-time job it was to reconcile telephone bills.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
And you'd be surprised to learn that that became a business opportunity and companies existed to take the telephone bills and optimize them for you.
They still exist, yeah.
And they still exist. And then what happened is the carrier said they'll do the optimization for you. So I think what we're seeing at the moment is that the market is, yes, you're right, you might end up with, you know, hundreds of internet circuits. But quite honestly, the price of an internet circuit, you know, $50 a month is a hell of a lot less than $1,000 a month for an MPLS circuit. So you're still better off even if you don't get to it in a timely fashion. And you can hire a, you know, fresh out of high school person in an Excel spreadsheet and just put them to work. It doesn't take a lot of effort. But if you think that's a challenge, then you can actually hire companies who just manage billing, telco billing for you, and can reconcile and test and validate.
And typically do more than just billing. They'll actually recommend providers in a given area for you and, you know, give you some intelligence so you don't have to go do all the research on what providers are providing good service at good prices in a given place. Really helpful if you're international too, but certainly work nationally. Those kind of folks are out there. But yeah, but that's a long way to say, Mark, I don't know of any easy way to take, because that's a problem. Yeah,
it's a problem.
It does happen.
And the last one is we're also seeing the rise of telcos as managed SD-WAN providers. We've seen all of the major players, Verizon, Orange, NTT, AT&T, all have managed SD-WAN services. In the case of, say, for example, Verizon, I think last time I looked at it, they had 6 different managed SD-WAN services. And the trick here, again, is to realize that some of those things that they call SD-WAN is just software configuration of the MPLS, the legacy MPLS, and some of it's, you know, VeloCloud or a managed Meraki. Like they actually have a service provider license to Meraki to put on customer premises. So you have to be able to sift through those and then be able to communicate that to the business on the difference between them is part of that. But the flip side of it is those carriers would then manage all the billing for you in theory. They'll probably just mess it up. And one day, once a year, you'll go and do a reconciliation and realize they're actually just charging you for everything and nothing's been ripped out. But, you know, not for me to be cynical, of course, but that's that. So there's another way of doing it, right? Is you either do it yourself, you buy an SD-WAN solution that's a router replacement and you organize it yourself. You go with a cloud provider who does a lot. Some of the cloud platforms themselves can help you do the asset management and the circuit reconciliations. So they'll give you a list of all the circuits. That does get easier when you have a look in their interfaces and spend time with them. And then the third one is give it to a carrier and let them do it for you as a managed service. So somewhere in between.
When you guys mention telco clearing houses, bill consolidation, you bring back bad memories. I used to work for one of those POTS aggregation companies. way, way back in the day. That's painful memories. Thank you very much.
So let's go around the table and start with Matt. Matt, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
My name is Matt Alley, Network Support Specialist, Financial Services, and my Twitter is at Matt Alley, and my blog is thenetworkalley.com.
Yeah, there you go. Welcome to the show, by the way, and thanks so much for putting yourself out there. I know you were a bit worried. You did well. It's been great. Darren. Well,
thank you.
Hi, I'm Darren Johnson. You can find me on Twitter at Dirty1Kenobi. I am a network automation engineer currently. You can find me on my blog that barely gets updated, DarrenJohnson.com. Thanks for having me on. Also on Pack.
Bill, you should get back to blogging. Trust me, it's the best resume generation tool ever. It really is the thing. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show. Anthony?
Hey, Anthony Miloslavsky. I'm a networking for a financial services company. You can find me on Twitter at PermitAnyAny.
My name is Mark Johnson. I'm a healthcare network engineer. I can't do short form because my AD is way too bad. But if you want to hit me up, you can give me my LinkedIn.
Fantastic. And we'll make sure that we get links to their LinkedIn profiles and their Twitter handles into the show notes. Well, thank you, Mr. Ethan Banks, for joining us as well. As always, any closing thoughts? Have you been inspired to return to the roundtable?
These are the great conversations because it does remind us where reality is, since you and I seem to talk to people who are way up there in the clouds, riding unicorns around and spinning rainbows. But reality is frustratingly not changing as much as it should be, it seems like.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this return to the roundtable and the format. We're going to run, and this one will be running on the weekly channel, but we're going to try and do these at least once a month and perhaps more often. And they may run between here and the weekly channel, and they may also run in the Priority Queue channel. So if you're not subscribed to the Priority Queue channel, you should jump over to packetpushers.net to check out how to subscribe. If you are not a part of our membership system, now's your great chance to do so, and where you can start to get notified about different things. We are moving to have new things going on. We have the Virtual Design Clinic, which is a virtual webinar or a virtual conference where you can come along and join in. It's for a couple of hours, for 4 hours. It's going to be like a conference style of thing. You'll be able to chat to people in chat rooms and then sit through some presentations on different topics. We also have our news and blogs, and I'm also trying to do a little bit of YouTube. So if you want to follow us on the YouTube and you can just search up Packet Pushers and subscribe, that would be something for funs because YouTube is kind of fun. And of course, you can find this and many more fine free other podcasts just along the same lines as this at packetpushers.net. You can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter as at Packet Pushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on the Facebooks if you must, and rate us on Apple Podcasts because that's actually the best way for us to stay here doing this. The ratings on Apple Podcasts are the best way for us to grow. So really would appreciate that. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.